Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from BBC Studios, the commercial subsidiary of the BBC.
Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the Talentworks podcast. If you haven't listened to us before, Talentworks is a production company within BBC Studios, and it's aimed at identifying forward-thinking talent with whom it can partner. The podcast is presented by Helen O'Donnell and me, Brona Monaghan. Thank you so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe.
I just wanted to start with a little, I kind of feel like Casper doesn't really need an introduction, but I've had the pleasure with both Helen and I've had the pleasure of working with Casper on a few projects. I think Casper is such a successful talent because he's taken his channel in an amazing direction, and he's worked across short form, long form. The project that we want to talk about today is actually Hit the Road, which Casper and Joe Sugg worked on with BBC Studios. And so I just thought that it was worth kind of playing a little clip from that in case anybody hadn't seen it before. Does that make you nervous?
Which one? we did two.
So this is from the first.
Oh no, the first. That's when we were learning how to, yeah, okay.
1 week, one mission. Casper Lee, Joe Sugg. Go outside.
We're traveling around Europe trying to look for jobs.
So yes, that was Hit the Road, which was a project that BBC Studios worked on with Casper and Joe, and so we want to talk about that project a little bit more today. But and also I should say that after Helen and I have finished questions, we're going to open it up to the audience. So if you think of any interesting questions you'd like to ask Casper, we'll have sort of 10 minutes at the end. So I kind of want to go back to the start. Casper, when did you first realise that you were creative?
I don't know. I don't know if I was creative growing up. I love watching YouTube. So that's why I started. I wasn't like the creative one in class. My sister kind of was way more creative, and she used to edit things all the time, so I thought that was awesome, and I used to watch her do that. But I just watched so much YouTube back in like 2009, 2008 in school, and just that was a great way to escape. Just, you know, being a teenager sometimes, it's just fun to watch people in America vlog their lives. I don't know if you guys remember the Shay Todds. Anyone? Yeah, I used to watch them all the time. Awkward now, but they were really family fun back then. So I made my first video that shows I'm not very creative was, I decided it would be a good idea to rate whether bathing or showering was more dangerous. That was a video idea I had. That was my very first YouTube video. What was more dangerous? And it got like 300 views. I was expecting like 100,000 overnight, but it got 300 views. Most of them mine because I used to refresh the video tab. You could do that up to 301 views back then. It worked really well. And then, and then I used to like have accounts and stuff. I would like my own things on and dislike. So it's always kind of been more of a hustle for me than being I wasn't like born with this incredible talent or creativity or whatever. It's always just been like, how can I get people interested in what I'm doing? And how can I work with people who are really creative to help boost that?
And you come from a really creative family as well. What was their reaction to when you first launched your channel? What did they think of what you were doing?
I think they're like, it's tough because creative family, they kind of know how difficult it is to make money in the creative industry firsthand. So I guess they'd kind of struggled, and like they became, like my dad and mom became estate agents at one point, even though they're such creative people, because it's just so difficult. So when they saw this new platform called YouTube, and they couldn't even understand it, so they thought it was a bit strange. Like maybe hid the fact how much I was actually watching and doing up in my bedroom. I'd maybe pretend to be doing my homework, but I was actually doing YouTube stuff. So maybe they didn't know. And then I told them I wanted to take a year out and do it full time, I was lucky that it was the first year after school. So that's kind of the time where you can make mistakes, and it's kind of maybe a better time to do it than if I was like starting now. I think it would be a lot harder. So it was a really pretty good transition from like grade 12, which is matric in South Africa, just to starting YouTube full time. And I took a year out to come to London and do that, and I'm still living here. So yeah, it worked out.
So do you think that was the tipping point for you when you came to London?
I think the tipping point was just connecting with other creators online. So I did that from South Africa. There was this website called YouNow. Does anyone remember YouNow? So I used to, it was like a website you go on webcam behind other people who went on webcam in front of an audience. And it was kind of brutal. They could vote you up or down. And if you had like more down votes than up votes, you'd be kicked off and someone else would come on. So I found a way to kind of hack that system and go on behind the biggest creators. And then eventually, like, as soon as I was on after them, I'd say, oh, I love their content so much. And they might still be watching, and some of them still watched. And then they saw my stuff and they like started sharing my stuff. And then I met up with, you know, Jack Scap. They'd make some really cool stuff still. They've actually gotten more into the filmmaking world, which is really interesting as well. But they picked, Jack Harris picked me up from the airport in like 2012. And as soon as I collabed with him, my world just, it all just exploded because everyone was collabing and I joined this wave of YouTubers. And we kind of went from there.
But I think that's something you've always been really good at, is kind of collaborating with people and knowing the network on YouTube, because I think, you know, YouTube, that is the beauty of it. It's such a collaborative platform. Yeah. And even globally as well, I know that you've got, you know, such a great network in kind of most territories. Yeah. Now, how do you feel that it, that has that changed at all?
Yeah, I think maybe people have maybe become a little bit more professional with the way they do stuff, whereas before you could just like get on with someone and then they would want to do a video with you because of that. And maybe now, because there's so much money involved, people are a little bit more hesitant and skeptical of your intentions, I suppose. So yeah, that may be starting to happen a little bit more, but yeah, I don't really like care. I'll just ask everyone until someone says yes, and then like it's just a numbers game. If you try enough, it's never not worth asking, basically, and you'll never get something without trying to get it, obviously, which is a cringe saying, but it's so true. So
I remember when we first met you, so we met you guys in 2015 maybe, 2015.
Yeah. So Brona was managing me at the time.
Yeah. So I was working at BBC Worldwide at the time, and I remember you and Joe saying that the secret to success was creativity, collaboration, and consistency.
I won't take, that's Joe's.
Oh, is it Joe's?
Three C's.
Oh, I've credited it to both of
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I was in the room when he came up with it. So
it's it's partly ours. Yeah. But yeah. I think that's a really good good three things to live by.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I guess Joe and I collaborating, the amount we did is testament to that. And it really just, it's the reason we were able to probably do what we did with you guys. Also a few other things happening in the BBC that aligned, and yeah.
And so I'd love to talk about the Hit the Road project. Yeah. So can you tell us what that was from your perspective and how it came about?
Yeah, so do you want the true story or is it a closed session?
We want the truth.
I think Jeremy Clarkson, he hit someone. And then, because I think the people, basically Brian Klein directed it, and he's the guy who usually does Jeremy's DVDs, one yearly like Christmas specials, if I'm right. So this is my perspective, at least.
Yeah, and he's the studio director of Top Gear.
Yeah, so studio director of Top Gear, and all of that happened with Jeremy Clarkson, and then they had like a free kind of month or a few months to make something else. And at the time, yeah, we pounced on it, we were the chosen ones. And I can't remember the exact moment, but just going into the BBC, I used to save my badges, my BBC badges, and put them on my wall, because I was like, this is crazy, we're in the BBC now. So it was a really big deal for us. And then we did the first one, and that was a whirlwind. We turned it into a lot of, you can go into what we turned it. It wasn't just a DVD, we turned it into a tour as well. But yeah, just working with someone like Brian Klein, and all, it wasn't just him, like the director, he brought on all of his like amazing producers, you guys, he brought on the best camera people in the business, and it was such an explosion of going from in our room, which you see at the start of that, to like these bigger cameras.
Yeah, so it was a collaboration between like short form expertise, like you guys were absolute expertise in what you were doing, and you know, linear experience with the Top Gear production crew. And you're right, it did kind of snowball in the fact that it started off as the 1 by 90 minute piece of content, but then we took it as a tour to Australia and New Zealand, which was nuts, wasn't it?
I think you did a calendar.
We did a calendar that sold more than Kylie or Tottenham Hotspur that year.
I think there was a stat. It was 50 Shades of Grey we beat on Amazon for a few days.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, how did you find working with a bigger production team? Because that was the first time you'd done something on that scale.
It is kind of daunting and so on. But Brian, Brian's not here, obviously, but he's just. It's hard to explain that he's really easygoing and fun, and he's like he becomes a mate very quickly on set, and then you feel comfortable when you've got someone on that level saying like what to do and directing you. I suppose it's important to have someone like that.
Did you ever find it? Did you feel that there was ever an element of risk?
Yeah, because we are so used to editing our own stuff, and I still edit my videos. I just think that's like the most important part of it for me, because it's quite unscripted what I do, and also this show was pretty unscripted, so I knew that the editing process was probably the most daunting, handing that over, and then we asked if we could be involved, and they said yes, so we were in the editing bay most of the time as well, so that kind of took away that fear. But just how you talk on a bigger screen versus how you talk on YouTube, it's weird, on YouTube you're a bit louder when you're talking, and it comes across well when you're like, hi guys, how's it going today? Like, that's fine on YouTube and it works nicely, but when you do it on there, like, we realized in the first one, we maybe felt a little bit louder than we should have been in terms of our, like, reactions, and then the second one I felt was a lot more, like, we learned so much from doing the first ones, which is strange, because you watch them both on a screen, but there's nuances that we didn't quite know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like, if it was 90 minutes of like, hey guys, it'd be just exhausting for the viewer.
Yeah, exactly. There's more of a storyline. Yeah.
And how did you find collaborating with Joe off platform? Was it any different?
Everything happened more on time, because when it's just us, We don't have to we didn't stick to a schedule so well back in those days. We just kind of made a video and then just put it up. And this was like, you have to be, I don't know, it was just a lot more structured, but fun as well, because we were going through the experience together. Between us, we just had such an easy experience. So yeah, it wasn't more difficult, I would say.
And also, it's nice having a friendly face every day to get through any of the tough moments.
Yeah, and someone to make fun of you when you need the toilet in the middle of like an American road. Oh, I won't go into that.
How did you feel then doing the live shows?
Oh, that was easier than doing something like this, I think. Even though I feel comfortable now at this kind of stuff, but doing a live show in front of a lot of people for some reason is less daunting than doing it in front of like a room where you can see faces. So luckily a lot of people came. It was quite tiring as well, kind of traveling around every day, meeting hundreds of people every day as well before the live show and doing that. But it was like, it's incredible to look back and see like, oh my gosh, like that was just such a, just seeing it all back is really makes it all worth it. And it's a great memory. It was funny enough, the live show, our host on the live show is Ian Sterling. So we kind of made his career. he was like, yeah. So now we listen to him every day. So that's a bonus. We get some insider information on Love Island.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that was very cool about the Hit the Road project was it existed in different mediums. So yeah. I think when you're coming up with an idea, it's always, I mean, if you're comfortable with both online and offline, it's always worth exploring, could this be a live show? Because I guess part of being a creator is having a relationship with your audience. And so I think once you took that into the live space, everyone went crazy for it.
Yeah, it was, It wasn't the craziest live show in terms of like massive things, but it was just like a proper. It was like us hanging out with our audience and having a good time and kind of doing things that were in the DVD, and people seemed to enjoy it.
So, absolutely. Yeah. So now, talking about the content on your channel now, I would say it has matured somewhat.
Depending on the week, depending on if I need views or not.
So you've dabbled in documentary on your channel. You've also done some animation projects that tend to take a little longer. Can you tell us about how you've formulated those ideas?
So I love Louis Theroux. I watch a lot. I like watching nonfiction stuff personally more than fiction. So I've always wanted to do a documentary, and I'm from Cape Town. Well, I'm from South Africa, near Cape Town, and I wanted to go back to Cape Town and talk about like the crime there and how the issues facing that city with the gang warfare. Like, it's crazy. It's basically a war zone just outside of the most beautiful city in the world. So don't put yourself off going to Cape Town. I'm sure a lot of you've been, and it's amazing. But there's like a side to it that was something I'd never experienced before, but I have a friend who's like Mr. Cape Town. He does everything. He's a paramedic, a police officer, and a good friend of mine. So he's like, I can take you for a week with our crew. And we went into what's known as the Cape Flats and just met up with gangsters, saw how the police work, met this guy who's in a gang. He's just talking about how he's killed people. We're sitting there literally, and people could be coming in at any point to come and shoot him. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's kind of strange. I usually make videos where I'm like in the ice bath, like screaming. It's like, this is weird. So that's the cool thing about having a YouTube channel, I suppose. You can do literally whatever you want. Maybe the viewers, like, it will be a different set of viewers on who watch that video. But YouTube has a really good algorithm at the moment that it will eventually find its audience. Like, an example of this, I might be going on a tangent, but like Josh did a video on tanks, right? He drove a tank through, my friend Josh, he's my roommate, he drove a tank through London. He got like 40,000 views in the first week, which he was disappointed in because he only has he gets like 100,000 views, and it's like, oh, why did I do that? I spent so much money on a tank. But a week later, like 2 weeks later, it's on 900,000 views because it got into the tank community, and everyone's like, this is not the tank you said, this is this tank. And like, so it's really cool to know that you can kind of step out of your box as a YouTuber. But what was the question? I've gone on a complete tangent.
No, that's right. Like, how do you find going on different formats? So the documentary, you've also done the animation projects.
Yeah. So I just know some really good animators. that's basically it. I write out a cool thing that I want to talk about. The animation projects in terms of being the movie or the...
Oh, no. I was meaning on your channel. Oh,
yeah,
on
the channel. Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
The fact that you've been in a movie.
No. But yeah, the animation projects is finding really good people who create really cool stuff, and they do all the animations. I can't draw for shit, but I find people who are good at what they do, and they help with that. So I write it out, and it's been very useful because I think like voiceovers become very powerful on YouTube. I've always thought that the audio quality is the most important thing to get right in a video before the video quality or anything else, because people are usually listening more than they're watching when they're on YouTube, because they might be doing two things at once. So like, animation is a great way to do that, because you just make sure that the audio is perfect and get a little cool animation over it.
No, what I really liked about your channel was you always used to treat it like a magazine show, which is like quite a technical traditional term, but that you had sort of your celebrity interviews, then you would have more sketch-based stuff, then you would have more prank-based stuff. Because I think people can go in maybe a couple of directions on YouTube. You could either go for a really niche subject and you will absolutely find the community that really, really love that topic and just want to hear you talk about it over and over. Or you can look at, you know, sort of more entertainment formats, and within that there's different strands, there's different sort of things that then you become known for.
Yeah, I think the smartest thing to do is go for the niche, so I think that's probably the best way to go about it these days. But I've just always done everything, so it's hard to stop.
And then, so you mentioned that you've been a voiceover in a movie. So how did that happen, and what appealed to you about doing that project? And
just,
what was it?
It just takes like a day to do, and then you're in a film. It's amazing. Because they do all the work, and you just go in and do the voiceover. And we were beavers, and it was really easy because you just scream, so it wasn't much acting involved, just screaming. So yeah, that was really fun. But Joe, I get a lot of these opportunities because of Joe.
Come on, mate.
So good at voiceovers. And like, he, I don't know if you've ever seen his impressions. And they're like, if we need, we have Joe, but we have to bring his mate with him. So I come along and I'm like, yeah, I can do a South African English accent. So yeah, that's cool.
And so what sort of content is inspiring you at the minute?
Oh, that's good. Ah, I don't know. I mean, I watch a lot of news on YouTube, so it's interesting to see, like, I think it's Channel 4. They upload like a lot of content. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you upload that much content? So it's like, and it's pretty good stuff. It's really up to date, and they're really smart about their YouTube. So that's quite interesting. But anyone I just watch so many random things. It's hard to go into. But I do. I like watching Line of Duty. That's quite a good storyline. Anyone watching that?
Yes.
So I sat behind her yesterday at this concert, and I.
Who's Vicky?
The I don't know her real name, but it's DCI Fleming.
Yeah, Vicky. Okay. So it's Vicky.
Yeah.
Vicky McClure.
Yeah, and she was in front of me yesterday, but yeah, she was she's amazing.
And do you engage it? Do you listen to any podcasts? Yeah.
Yes, I kind of listen to a lot of my favorite kind of audio to listen to now is Calm, the story books by Calm when you're going to sleep. So that's when I kind of listen to things. It just makes me so relaxed and like go on an adventure through time travel and all of that. But yeah, we have a couple of people we manage called Sophia and Cinzia who have an amazing podcast called The Girls Bathroom, and I've been enjoying that. Bit different for someone like me to be listening to it, but it's kind of interesting to hear what girls talk about in the bathroom.
It did really well, didn't it? It got to the top of the iTunes.
Yeah, so I'm really enjoying that as well.
Yeah, so how are you finding working with other creators now on the management
side? So difficult. I've got one right there, Mark.
Mark Ferris.
It's really good. I think I've always worked with creators, but usually for my channel. But now it's like working with creators for their channels a lot more. So that's really fun as well, and collaborating and just running a company. It's really interesting.
So I'd like to open up some questions to the audience.
Question: you said you think it's smarter to focus on a niche. Why?
Well, in terms of if you're doing, it depends. First and foremost, you have to enjoy what you do. But if you're looking from a financial point of view, you don't need to get as many views on your videos to work with brands if you've got a niche. So that's pretty much the reason. And also, there's maybe less competition than going just the broad, I want everyone to love me for me. Whereas if you're talking about a niche, they love what you're talking about. And then you can kind of jump onto that now, which is because it's so difficult just to become what you known as back in the old days, we all just came up for who we were, I think, and now you kind of have to come up for what you talk about and how good your content is. So I'd go for a niche as well, because then you can if you're doing golf, you only need 10,000 views, and then you probably get a great golf sponsorship, rather than if you're just doing comedy. Brands don't know exactly what audience you have sometimes when you don't have a niche, and then they don't spend money as efficiently.
Has there been a particular niche that you've been looking at and you think, oh yeah, that's great, I'd like to get in on this? So is there anything that you might be looking into that you want to dabble in?
Joe's, I manage with, my management company is with Joe. We started it together, and he's obsessed with fishermen. So he thinks the next big niche on YouTube is fishermen. But I think gaming, obviously, that's not a small niche, but I'd love to get involved in that. It's just going to keep growing. I mean, let's talk about the Olympics and all that. It's just so mainstream now. And it would be cool to kind of manage an athlete. That would be fun, a gaming athlete. But I'm trying to think. Cars are great as well, probably a very smart one to get into.
For your BBC shows that you did, how involved were you in the pre-production? For example, the road trip. Did you help decide where you're going to go and what activities you'll do when you were there?
I was pretty involved. I remember. It was the first one. So we went around Europe first. I'm pretty sure I knew where we were going to go. That wasn't the one where we weren't meant to know where we were going to go, was it?
No. So the first one, we would have pre-production meetings at BBC Studios that Casper and Joe would come along to. There would be, so the inception of the idea kind of formed together. We knew that there was going to be some kind of road trip adventure. That was about that it as the starting point, and we formulated it all together. Then the team would come up with ideas, and we'd almost bounce it off everybody in the room. It was very collaborative in terms of, I think, Joe and Casper were very humble in terms of taking on ideas from other people in the room. And equally, everybody else was very respectful as to Joe and Casper's thoughts on...
We made sure that was in the contract.
In terms of like what would go, you know, what felt authentic to the audience, because it wouldn't have, we weren't creating a show and dropping Joe and Casper in as hosts. It was their show. And I think that's two very specific ways of doing things in terms of, I've got an idea from a show and maybe Casper could host, but maybe you could host it, or I'm making Casper's show. Do you see what I mean?
And the second one, we didn't know as much because there were more surprises. That's why I was just working out. But yeah, it was, we still knew like what we wanted to do, but we wanted to keep some stuff a surprise, and we trusted Brian by then.
Yeah, so that was a learning from the first one in terms of the improvised elements on camera worked really well. So how do we create those moments whilst Joe and Casper still feeling safe in the environment of the show? I mean, we still needed to deliver a 90-minute piece of content at the end of it. But like you say, there was a lot more surprises along the way.
Yeah. Hi, Casper. I was just wondering, from a TV producer's perspective, obviously, you know, years and years ago, it would be a case of we would look for talent and then for a specific subject, and then we would bring them in. They would learn a lot from how we would do things. But as co-creators, obviously managing editing, but also your own content, what is it you think that we as producers or the industry in general, broadcast industry, could learn from you guys?
Oh, yeah. Everything. No, I don't know. That's a tough one. I think maybe not worrying so much about, depends on the, obviously the content you're making and like what format it is, but if it's kind of non-scripted, not worrying so much about the quality of the shots and making everything so perfect. It's just so much more important what people are saying and if it feels real and if it's just an entertaining thing. I think some of the biggest YouTubers in the world, like, there's this guy from, he does scripted stuff. There's this guy from India who was like the biggest Indian YouTuber. I don't know if he still is. No, I think T-Series took over. But he had like 7 million viewers every video, and he just did it all on his iPhone. And he was all the characters, and it would just be on his iPhone, and that was it. And like, people enjoyed it still because the content was so engaging. So I guess maybe not worrying so much about how perfect the shot looks, but also you do have standards you have to keep up too, so it's a double-edged sword. But I'd say, yeah, definitely more about the content than the quality of the shots. And yeah, as a talent, I don't like waiting around for the lighting to look good, so I just want to go. But yeah, I think that's one. Do you have any? I'm sure you guys also have points on that one.
Well, I agree from that perspective. Like, in a documentary, the best moments are sort of those really candid moments that might be just caught on someone's phone. And I think the way that people are consuming content now, because so much is consumed through your phone, you're not as kind of sensitive to really high quality camera. I mean, it depends on the show, obviously. Game of Thrones has to be shot on the most expensive stuff, you
more
know,
non-scripted,
exactly.
But also don't cringy try and do like a vlog scene where you're like, oh, he's a YouTuber, he has to do a vlog scene where we see him with the camera and then the camera is all just,
I think a point to add is the quickness of turning something around. Yeah. So I think that's something really great in the online space, that you can have an idea and turn it around relatively quickly. And I think in linear timelines, sometimes because it has to go through so many people, it ends up feeling sometimes slightly out of date by the time it comes out. Whereas you guys can have an idea, turn it around, and it happen, as opposed to thinking about a trend that might have happened a year ago and then trying to...
And also, you can use YouTube maybe to pilot some of your ideas and just see how they do and if people like them. I think that's a great thing about, you can like make so many mistakes on YouTube and then you can see exactly straight away if people like it or not. So, yeah.
How did you go about developing your live show? So the one that you did with the BBC, had you already done it in a format before?
Yes, no, I don't think so. I think you guys helped a lot. Ian Sterling's really funny as well, so he carried the whole thing pretty well. Do we bring on a live show coordinator, someone who directed the live show we did, right? Sorry, my memory's very hazy.
No, it was the hazy days. Yeah. We so the format of the live show was people seeing the piece of content before anyone else. So it was clips from the show interspersed with Q&A with Joe and Casper, and then games. It was basically like bringing to life parts of the YouTube channel on stage. So there was like the ice bath thing that worked really well.
And it wasn't groundbreaking theatre, but it was like, it was just really fun and stuff that we knew the audience who would come to would enjoy. Because like there's a particular audience of ours who are going to come to the events and they're usually more young and looking for the challengey type stuff.
Yeah, and I think also that is a testament to turning a project around really quickly. So we decided we were doing the live show in September and they happened in November in New Zealand and Australia. So it was a really quick turnaround, but they all sold out and they had a really good atmosphere in the room.
And like Live Nation we worked with, they were really good as well. So yeah.
So Casper, thank you so much for joining us today. For everyone, yes, big round of applause.
Thanks for listening. If you want to find out more about us, we're on Instagram at BBC Studios Talentworks.
This podcast is produced by Shola Aleje for BBC Studios.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.